Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a special interview edition of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. Today, we've got something pretty special for you. As some of you may know, The Immigrant, the movie by director James Gray that we talked about on this podcast a couple weeks ago, has actually hit Netflix Watch Instant. So you can get out and see that on your computer or on your Netflix-enabled TV device. And we highly recommend it. We loved the film, and we have something special for you today. Nick Newman actually was able to sit down and interview director James Gray a while back. The interview has been on thefilmstage.com for a while in its written form, but to celebrate the fact that it's now available for everyone to see on Netflix Watched Instant, we're actually going to release the audio of that interview for you to listen to at home. So watch the movie, it's really great, and then listen to the interview that Nick Newman does. It's fantastic. It'll tell you a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff about the movie and its creation. As always, give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. If you have any things you'd like to say to us, you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Other than that, sit back, relax, and enjoy the interview. And don't forget to tune in next week when we will be talking about Richard Linklater's Boyhood.
And of course it was. It took me like, you know, typical New York fashion, took me like 40 minutes to go like 5 blocks.
So,
how you doing?
It's good. Hi, it's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. It was also really funny because when I got in, which was 2 days ago, first of all, there was the train derailment in Queens, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, to get from Kennedy Airport to my hotel at 5 p.m. on a Friday night, it took over 3 hours.
Okay.
And then that night, they were doing construction on the street below the hotel all night. Beep, 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 beep. You know that thing where you back up and it makes that noise? And at that moment, I said, why do I like New York? I think I hate New York. It was really bad. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, no, it's fine.
Wait, we're okay for another 2 minutes, right? We're bullshitting, so let me turn off my phone.
Yeah, sure.
This is my driver who's having a heart attack. It's in traffic anyway.
It's funny because one of the first things that I was going to ask you was, you know, do you like doing promotion for your movie, you know, at home in New York? I mean, is it, because you've, you know, you took the movie to Cannes and it's, you know, it's been playing around. And I know you went to Chicago as well with the film.
I went to Chicago for about 3 hours.
Okay.
That was one of the craziest trips ever. By the way, I love Chicago. I don't know if you've ever been there.
No, I haven't. No.
It's a fantastic city and they have great museums, and it's an incredibly beautiful place. But, it's strange, you know. It's weird. It's like, I did come for the New York Film Festival.
Yeah, so I was at the Q&A there, yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun for me. And I have to say, I had never had a film of mine play there before.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I didn't think about how important it was to me until it happened, because when they told me that they were going to play the film and that this, you know, finally measure, you know, the release date or whatever, finally hooked up. I mean, it was all I could do not to shed a tear, as corny as that sounds. Mm-hmm. I was thrilled. It's, you know, I grew up over there, 9 miles in that direction from Queens. Mm-hmm. So it's very weird for me to be here, actually. Very weird for me to be in this space. Growing up, I never had a view of Manhattan like that, I'll tell you that.
And where are you living right now? Or?
I live in Los Angeles for many reasons. I was here, obviously, for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved back to L.A. because, how do I put this without sounding crass? I kind of couldn't afford to live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I have 3 children, whom I love dearly. And for me to live here, the infrastructure costs are just, they're huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Which wasn't even the case as of about, you know, 10 years ago. But this whole, you know, 1%, 99% thing has become more evident in London and New York and Paris and now even a little bit. And it's become so expensive. I mean, even like things like a quart of milk, it's like twice as expensive in New York as it is in California. So for that reason, we moved out there. But my wife and I were talking, you know, we talk about it all the time. We would love to be back here.
Mm-hmm.
We love it here. It's great. It's great.
And, I mean, I guess one thing I've kind of wondered is, you know, your movies, including this one, which is a period piece, even exploring a New York that I don't know, they still kind of make me look at the city in a different way. They seem to capture the city in a way I feel like I don't see very often. And I kind of wonder, just sort of speaking maybe a bit broadly and speaking in terms of your whole career, did you start looking at New York differently once you became a filmmaker, once you were looking at it through a camera lens? I mean, did the city become a different place after you had captured it on film?
That's a great question. Well, what I would say is, the way I would look at it is this way. First of all, most of the films that I saw about New York growing up did not capture the New York that I knew. That doesn't mean they didn't capture New York.
Right.
Like, if you looked at a Woody Allen movie from the late 1970s, if you looked at Manhattan or Annie Hall, it would certainly capture New York in the 70s. Certainly Annie Hall does, really. But it wasn't the Manhattan. I didn't grow up in Manhattan. It wasn't the New York that I knew. I knew kind of much more working class Archie Bunker,
right,
you know, side to the city. And so I have, of course, a great love, obviously, for those movies. And to say I love Martin Scorsese's films is the understatement on the century, and Francis Ford Coppola's, you know, Godfather films, of course, shot here. But they, even as much as I adored them, and obviously they're my favorite movies, they weren't about Queens, you know, working class Queens where I was from. So it was always my attempt to put that, and also Brooklyn, where my grandparents are from and all that, was to put that on film. So what you're saying, I mean, I'm very grateful for it, but it's just an attempt to put my grandparents' place on film and my place on film. I mean, my place where I grew up was the Yards, and where my grandparents grew up has been Little Deaths and Two Lovers. And, you know, We on the Night is sort of a mix of both.
Yeah.
So the new film is, that's actually my, you know, my grandparents when they first came. So it's sort of my attempt to be as personal as possible is really what you're talking about.
And, you know, I mean, I've heard you talk about when you made this film, this was your most personal film because it comes from recollections that your grandparents provided when you were a child. And, you know, seeing the film, it's funny because obviously I thought of the flashbacks of Godfather Part II. I thought of Once Upon a Time in America. Uh-huh. Those definitely came to mind. But I don't know, it's still, to me, it kind of still felt like your New York in a way. And I guess what I'm trying to ask is sort of, did this film more than any other bear also a cinematic influence, just sort of your, sort of the forefathers of capturing the old New York? I mean, did you feel that more than, say, you would have felt a Scorsese influence on, like, We Own the Night, or you would have felt a certain such influence on Two Lovers? I mean,
the influences of the immigrant would be very unlikely, probably, for you, because they weren't the you're quite right. Obviously, Godfather II, Francis Coppola did that perfectly. I mean, you cannot capture the Lower East Side, Lower Manhattan from 1917, I think that movie takes place, in a way that's any better. So we didn't watch it before shooting this, because we knew that no matter what we did, we would owe a debt to it. We did look at Fellini's La Strada, believe it or not, which took on a kind of... it was almost like our Bible, you know, which was weird, because what we were trying to do was not make a historical document. We were trying to do something that had a kind of almost a fable simplicity about it. And so the cinematic influences that you're talking about, you know, Godfather II, Once Upon a Time in America. Once Upon a Time in America we didn't watch at all, because that is very much Sergio Leone's kind of fantasy. I mean, he's a great director, but it's a different thing. We looked at the historical stuff. We looked at autochromes. Do you know what autochromes are?
Yeah.
I think I've talked about that in New York.
You may have.
I may not have. I don't know. You forget these things. But it's basically like almost like fake color photographs, Nick, where you make the... it's a black and white series on glass, and then they dye the glass, each pane of glass a different color. And then when they put them together, it looks like color. This is 1905, 1910, the Lumiere autochromes, they're called.
Yeah.
So we looked at those, and we looked at the Ashcan School of Painters. We looked at Everett Shin, William Glackens, George Bellows, John Sloan, very important group of painters from the turn of the last century. You know, Edward Hopper was one of them, too, although a little bit later. And we tried not to get cinematic influences, but then you wind up anyway, you know? It's like America, America, and Godfather 2, and then it winds up being in the movie because I'm a movie nerd. So you can't really avoid it. But we tried, usually on other films, you're quite right, I have watched other movies before making the film. Like for The Yards, I watched Rocco and His Brothers and showed it to the crew and watched it 400 times. But for this, I tried not to do that, but it wound up, you know, those movies wound up being in there anyway.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I'm glad that you talk about sort of these different coloring processes and different forms of art which inspired it, because I've seen the movie twice now, and both times I'm just continually really struck and sort of astounded by the color palette of the film. You know, it, to me, it almost... It's funny because I bring up those films which are at least 30 years old, and, you know, they're sort of the saying, you know, they don't make them like they used to.
Right.
And that's kind of how I feel about this film, just if for nothing else, just in terms of the color palette you've devised, and, you know, you work with Darius Kanji on this film. I guess the first question I would have about your collaboration is how much of the film is sort of you and how much of it is him, where your collaboration with the cinematographer, how exactly that works, basically,
right,
is what I'm trying to ask.
Right. It's a very good question. It's a different dynamic with different cinematographers. It actually depends on the cinematographer. I prefer a lot of input from the people with whom I'm working, because if it's, I've said this before, but it's true. The process is like, you know, it demands huge ego by the director, particularly if you're a writer-director, to say, okay, what I've written is so important that we should spend millions of dollars and, you know, years on it and stuff. And then once you get to make the film, once you get to that point in the process, to forget your ego completely and to start including everybody's ideas that you think will help the movie.
Right.
So Darius and I worked very closely, and he was... I think once I laid down the ground rules about what I was after, he sort of went and expanded upon what it is I had in mind. And it was he who brought to me a lot of religious paintings, you know. And he talked about the heavy religiosity which was in the script, which I didn't even really consciously think about, and which has been, in candor, quite undiscussed, which is, you know, the serious degree to which religion played a role in those characters' lives.
Yeah.
Because we live such a secular existence now in New York, and 2014 in Europe is very secular as a continent. You know, the middle of this country is not so secular, but
right.
but you know, a lot of us tend to, you know, scoff at it. But the truth is it's an important thing in people's lives. It was important for her. And so he brought to me a lot of religious painting, which I hadn't thought about. I had thought more about the Ashcan school. So we talked a lot about the color scheme, and the way that we discussed it was in terms of the autochromes. We also talked about, you know, the quality of the air, which was incredibly bad. From 1920, it was mostly all coal and wood burning that provided the air. So it would have been a huge amount of particulate in the atmosphere. And so this idea of lack of sunlight was not some conceit that we created to be cool. It was really based on reading about what the heck was going on in the city back then. And also, this color palette, which is very much Gordon Willis, Wilmore Zsigmond, all those guys.
Yeah, exactly.
It comes from a place which is from historical fact. There's no fluorescent light, obviously, in 1920. It was, you know, gas light was mostly gas light in the tenements. There was some electricity, but not a lot. And you're talking gas light as a very kind of ochre, you know, burnished look to it.
Yeah.
So it would be ahistorical for me to make a scene that had a kind of a green pallor or something, or a blue. Those color schemes, and also the fabrics were earth tones. They were the suits that men basically had, two suits that they bought and wore them their whole lives. The thread counter was one of the thickest, most tough suits ever, and they were black or brown.
Okay.
You know, so the history of it really dictated a lot of the color palette, but also it was this religious painting aspect which Darius brought to it. So each cinematographer you work with in a different way, but I was very specific with Darius, and Darius was very specific with me.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great collaboration. I loved him. I've had great collaborations with all the cinematographers with whom I've worked. Certainly, I mean, I loved Harry Savitas, although, you know, obviously he's dead now, which is quite tragic. But I had the same kind of relationship with him. And it's that's the most rewarding thing about making a film for me, that and the sound mix, the relationship with the cinematographer.
Okay. Well, you know, you talk about, it's funny because watching it both times, I was thinking about how, you know, there is that sort of that sepia burnish look, but then you also have these moments where it's almost startling in the movie when it has kind of like this gray white tone to it. I mean, is that, I feel like there's definitely sort of an emotional connection there, particularly when Eva has her flashback to her sister. I mean, something like that, I mean, that's, you talk about this in these very, you know, these technical terms and also just in terms of historical.
I'm sorry, am I getting too technical?
No. It's very, very interesting, and I really like hearing how much you've clearly researched this, talking about thread count and things like that. Things which, you know, it seems like most filmmakers would kind of pass up. It's fascinating to hear that, but at the same time, I guess I feel like there's also just such an emotional dictation there as well.
Oh, absolutely. It's 100% of the experience. I mean, look, you can research the thread count of a suit all you want, and that's nice, but if it doesn't work emotionally, it's worthless. I mean, you mentioned the dream that she has with the sister, which we overexposed the film at that point, which we did on purpose because you want some moment of relief, visual relief.
Yeah.
It couldn't be 100% dark with, you know, dark with ochres and browns. I mean, at a certain point, you have to have some, and we did try to vary it a little bit without going crazy. You know, it's interesting you're talking about this because I saw on the plane, I had, of course I've seen it about a million times, but I watched Bonnie and Clyde on the flight here, which is, I think, a great, great movie. And I some people maybe say dated, I don't know, I think it's fantastic. And in the movie, the photography is one thing, and then, you've seen the film, right? About three quarters of the way into the movie, she says, I want to see my mama. And they go see Faye Dunaway's mother.
Yeah.
And the mother says, you best keep running, Clyde. I don't know. And it's like the saddest scene in the world. And it visually, it looks completely different from anything else in the film. Heavy filtration in front of the camera.
Right.
This slow motion in this weird kind of step-printed way. And it seems kind of almost distant, irretrievable.
Right.
And the scene is remarkable, not just because it's a great scene, which it is, and brilliantly acted, which it is, and the context narratively is great, but the style of it is different from the rest of the film, and as a consequence, the emotional impact is even more heightened. So you're always looking for moments where you can give some measure of visual relief, because it's about the emotion of it. If it's all one color, which I've been guilty of, by the way, I've made that mistake, it's all one color, and then you have to kind of vary it as best you can. So it's tricky, though. It's a very tricky balance, because what you're asking, what we're talking about here is, if you vary it too much, then the film starts to lack consistency, which is important.
Okay.
But if you don't vary it at all, it lacks
variety, texture,
and it's a monotone, you know. So, and I don't know if I've certainly mastered that balance at all. It's a very difficult thing, and by the way, it's also different for different people. Some people demand more consistency from the films, and some people demand less. There's no way. It's just you do what you think feels right. But of course, it's always linked to the emotion. And when we go through the script with the cinematographer, always that's the first thing we're always talking about. What is the core emotional idea, narrative idea and emotional idea in every scene?
Yeah.
And how do you highlight that visually? That's where you come out first, I think.
You know, we're talking about these very in-depth processes on the film, so it feels weird to bring up the film's trailer, but I'm good friends with Keith Ulick, and he had told me that his quote is featured in the trailer for the film, and he told me that you yourself actually edited the trailer for the
film. Well, I didn't choose the quotes.
Okay.
What happened was they had there was an international trailer, which I had nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And in candor, I saw the international trailer and hated it.
Okay.
I thought it was really cheesy and it didn't represent the film at all. So, knowing that people might want to use the international trailer. I said to my editor, you know, we better cut together our own trailer. And if they don't like it, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if they like it, great. So we cut it together, and I left, because the international trailer had quotes too, so I just left sort of slugs for the quotes.
Okay.
And then the assistant editor, he found a bunch of quotes. So I guess Keith has to thank him.
Okay.
The edit that I put together, and to their infinite credit, the Weinstein Company said, we love the trailer, let's just put this out.
Yeah.
And they changed it, not at all,
yeah.
Which is almost unheard of. But I you know, I like the trailer, but who the hell knows? I mean,
I think it's beautiful. I think it's
I'm glad to hear that.
Really effectively. I remember actually when the trailer came out, I'd seen the movie back in October, and I kind of thought, and I was soon to see it again, so I thought, well, I don't really need to see a preview. Then I heard you edited it, and I just gave it a look, and I thought it was really magnificent. I'd wonder the process of editing a trailer. I mean, was
it's very
that,
different.
Was that something different. New to you, too?
Totally new.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the hell I was doing. It's really different. It's, I'm not an expert on that, let alone other things. I'm not an expert on that for sure, and my editor and I just basically kind of, we just fly, it's because you want to, you keep a little mystery, but at the same time you want to indicate what the story is.
Right.
And you want to feature some of the film's visual splendor, but you don't want to reveal all of it. I don't know, we just kind of winged it a little bit, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad you like it. I mean, we looked at the trailer to Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
What other trailers did we look at? We looked at Raging Bull. We looked at the trailer to The Shining, which is actually one shot. It's just the blood coming from the elevator doors.
Okay.
And we looked at, you know, we looked at a bunch of movies' trailers.
Mm.
A lot of great movies have terrible trailers, by the way, because the filmmakers don't generally edit the trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, that's probably a good thing, because the filmmaker is too close to the material and stuff. But it had been, you know, remembering this, it had been a year since I shot the movie. So I had some distance from it, you know, which is weird. Usually that's not the case. And when we were cutting the trailer together, I realized I hadn't seen the film in a year.
Hmm.
So I had some, not a lot, but some distance from it.
Okay.
More than you usually do.
Yeah, well, sometimes there's a benefit to, maybe in this case there was a slight benefit to having this long gap between premiere and release, but
it's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I wonder how it's going to alter or not alter the perception of the film.
Yeah,
it's very strange to me. You never know. Some films get hurt by it, and some films get helped.
Right.
It's no way to know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I watched it, and one of my first thoughts was, I haven't seen a trailer in this long that. It's not often I see a trailer for a film after I've seen the movie itself, but unfortunately that's the case. But
right.
It's not often where I have that experience and I think, wow, this sells it perfectly. And then, after I saw the film again, I thought I did a very good job, is all.
I'm glad to hear that. I'll tell my editor. He'll be thrilled.
Great. So I think I have time for just one more question. You know, I won't ask you just like, I won't ask you for like an exclusive, like, what are you doing next or anything, because that's not really what I'm interested in. What I am interested in, though, is just that I feel like now you have maybe more potential projects on your plate than ever before, at least after a film has come out. It seems like you have several options out there. And what I would ask, just to kind of end things on, is does it feel strange to have that there? Because I remember, you know, after your films come out, generally, it seems like there's a bit of a quiet period. But now you're in the news quite a bit. I'm seeing your name in Variety about various projects which you might do. Does that feel strange to have this movie coming out and have other things in development actively?
It feels good.
Yeah.
You know, making films is very hard. It's really hard. It's hard on every level, and
wait.
I love doing it, and it's a beautiful. It's funny, yesterday, the other day, somebody said to me, a very close friend of mine said, we were talking about luck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have bad luck for this? Bad luck? I said, I don't have bad luck at all. To make a film, you're like the luckiest person ever.
Yeah.
And I just want to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the frustrating things for me is that I've made 5 movies, which is not bad, and I'm pretty young comparatively, but I also started when I was 23. My first film was 20, I was 23, so I'm pretty slow. Mm-hmm. And I'm not slow, I mean, I work, the scripts don't take that long, but to get them made has been very hard and taken a long time, and to that, I miss the privilege of making films. So what I've tried to do lately is to attach myself to more things, because I'm interested in a lot, and whatever happens, whatever goes first, I go make.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to work more. And in the end, because it's not like, you know, 1928 or 1950. Actually, 1950 is, you know, that's sort of that period is the studio period, right? 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. where, and then 1949 comes antitrust and it's pretty much over. But back then, you know, Alfred Hitchcock made 60 movies. John Ford right. made 80 movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you find is narrative is really difficult. Telling a story on film is really hard, and it's like a craft. I've talked about this too. It's like, I want to keep doing it and get better at it because I'm not where I want to be yet. And a lot of that is, an element of craft. So you ask about, does it feel weird? It's very strange in a great way because I want to be able to keep doing it, and I hope I can.
Yeah. I hope you can too.
That's, thank you. I mean, some people don't, you know? To me, it's all you can ask because it's a great privilege. Well, yeah, I guess that means we're over?
Yeah.
When he stands there, you know, it's like, there he is, looking very serious. You're looking very Talmudic with the beard these days.